Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the first episode of our new fall season. And what better way to start off than a show about food origins? Stay tuned. Well, we talk a lot about food origins on this weekly journey through culinary history. Welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And today is no exception, but it's a very kind of special exception in a way, because we're going to be talking about a magazine issue. Strange, you think? There are food magazines, and then there is Saveur. And Saveur has come out with a brand new theme. I guess we'll find out more about whether it's going to be a recurring theme or not. And it's called the Origins Issue. And yes, of course, there are beautiful pictures of food and there are recipes. And it's, you know, one of those yummy magazines that you get to eat up. But there is so much wonderful information in there about travel, about interesting food origins, like where did nachos get its name, and who invented the Reuben, and what were some of the very first Native American foods? That and so much more. And my special guest today is the editor-in-chief of Saveur magazine, Adam Sachs. Adam is an award-winning food writer, having received numerous James Beard Awards, and has been writing about food including pieces for Condé Nast and Traveler, GQ, Food and Wine, Departure. A kind of a travel and food writer.
A travel and food writer, yeah.
He was also the editorial director at Tasting Table until he was named editor-in-chief and kind of overall editorial director of Saveur magazine. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This new issue, I have to say, is very, very cool.
I love whatever's
left of this food, of the glossies.
I mean, are there still others out there?
There are. Maybe one, two. But I do get them all and have gotten them all from the beginning. In fact, some of my collections were sought after by a couple of people. But this one is, you know, it's interesting. I love all of them, and they all serve a particular interest. And after I leaf through some of the others for the recipes, and ooh, do they have a recipe for lamb this week, or this month, and you know, what are some of the new kitchen gadgets? But when Saveur arrives, I set aside time because I know I'm going to get a little more absorbed in the articles in that magazine. So it's, you said, and I'm going to quote you too.
Uh-oh.
So you better hold up to this. Well, but you said that it's always been Saveur's mission to bring the reader to the source of unique and delicious food. In fact, you said, for me, it is a dream job because Saveur is a magazine about following food to its source. And indeed, this issue does it in spades.
Yeah.
What brought you to make this issue?
This issue? Well, I mean, it's in keeping with, I think, the general Saveur mission, which is, what, as you said, following food to its source. And you know, we want to have delicious recipes, and you want to look at a picture of something and want to make it right away. But I think what we do, that's a little bit different than some of our friends at other magazines, is that we try to give stories around everything. Every Saveur story has to have a sense of place, a sense of a voice, a context. And you know, you described it perfectly, that I hope that we make a magazine that you do want to keep around, that, you know, if you, maybe you keep it around to make the dish, you know, a couple times, it enters your repertoire, or maybe you just want to read that story when you've got time. And this was an issue that we came up with because we started talking about, you know, wouldn't it be neat to sort of scratch the surface of normal things like vanilla, and what, you know, where does vanilla actually come from, or things that are staple foods that you see every day, but you don't know the backstory. And I mean, it's one of the things I love about journalism in general and food and travel journalism specifically, is that almost anything, if once you look into it, you know, there's some origin myth, there's some story about where it came from, there's some interesting trajectory about how it ended up being something that we all take for granted. And invariably, once you go down that, you know, sort of rabbit hole of looking into stuff, there are interesting stories out there. So I think, you know, there's a lot of... There are a lot of sources for recipes out there, and obviously we have recipes, but you want to tell a story around food.
Absolutely. Well, you don't have to convince me. I mean, I get to indulge myself and my own interests in culinary history and do this on a weekly basis. Right. And my listeners, my regular listeners, know that that's what we do every week, is we kind of, you know, we scratch below the surface and we get into the stories. Some of them can be really esoteric too, but, you know, involving, you know, like how did people set the table and, you know, and how to eat. So what I think is interesting is a lot of people, an interesting story. I was, talking to a friend, you know, an acquaintance, and something, for some reason, a dish came up. We were eating dinner and a dish came up. It was about the potatoes and something about the Irish as well. Of course, you know, with, you know, the potatoes from Ireland, potatoes being Irish. And I'm going,
what?
He said, well, you're kidding. I said, no. He said, come on. And I said, trust me, they're not from Ireland.
Right.
And so for people like that who aren't, maybe they're not into history. They don't really, you know, they like to eat.
Right.
But they don't really care so much about, you know, the origins and the stories, the backstories of food. Right? This is, I don't want to say a primer, but it's a nice little fun introduction, because it's a story that you can get into and you can get the source without having to read and do a lot of research and go through tomes of
right.
You know,
you might not pick up a full size book about cod, but I think if we do our job well, then you're going to be pulled into a story because it's got, you know, narrative and intrigue and it piques your curiosity. And it's sort of, you know, these aren't scholarly stories. These are written by, you know, food and travel journalists who just dig a little deeper for this issue than sometimes.
Right. And that's one thing that I wanted to ask you about. And that was, did you assign these topics in these stories, or did some people, because some of them seem so much kind of like this person's bailiwick and something that they would naturally go and do. Did they pitch a particular story to you, or?
It's always, you know, when we're trying to sort of put together the mix for a particular issue, it's, I think at its best, and it usually is this way, it's kind of a medley of, you know, some stories originate in editors' minds, but a lot of stories come from writers, as you say, going after, they've got something they're curious about, or they've always wanted to dig into something. I'm a weird editor in a lot of ways, but I'm a weird editor in that I spent most of my career as a writer on the other side of the table or equation. So I'm very sympathetic to the plight and needs and enthusiasms, especially of writers. And I always felt that, you know, the writers are the ones out there. You know, we're thinking about how to put the magazine together and you know, how all the elements hang together. But the writers are the ones who are out in the field seeing stuff and talking to people. So I really like it. I think some of the best stories come from writers who say, you know, I saw this and I want to go back and follow it and dig a little deeper.
And obviously some people have written a lot about this on their articles. And you've got some high profile, but some well-known names in the food world writing.
Yeah.
Well-known writers. Fuchsia Dunlop writing about soy sauce. Yeah. And Lev Lior writing about spices.
You didn't pronounce his last name either. I was nervous you were going to ask me to say his name.
I know
Lior.
I know it. It's Lior. Lior.
Lior
Lev.
He's like Madonna. He's right.
We'll get it there.
Word.
Right. Writing about spices, and he runs, you know, a terrific spice business, and has written, is coming out with a book shortly.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Fuchsia and Lior are perfect examples of people who, you know, you could call them probably in the middle of the night and say, tell me an interesting story about soy sauce in you know, Fuchsia's case. I think that's one where we called her and said, you know, is there a story about soy sauce? And of course, having done, you know, so much research and gone so deep with that stuff, she had a great story. So, and Lior, obviously the same. His book is lovely and about all different kinds of spice. So when we asked him about vanilla, of course, he had lots of great things to talk about.
And vanilla is such a beautiful, that's such a great story. That's a good one.
The photos, I really love
them. Well, and that's just, as you said, you were a travel and food writer, and you are no stranger to traveling, as I've read and in some of your past biographies. And on a show here, I think last year you talked a lot about your extensive travel.
Right.
So this for you was, was a natural, hey, go and find out about it. Did you send these writers on these faraway places?
Yeah, most of them we did. I mean, I think I think some of them had been, it was part of a larger research project or tacked onto another story. But for most of these, I loved writing, and I still occasionally do it. But the great part of being an editor is being able to, talk with a writer about a story and then say, okay, go get on a plane. Because that's where good stories come from, the plane itself. Yeah. But or there are people who are based in places where they can tell great stories.
Okay. Spoiler alert: the story about potatoes. Follow the trail of the Incas high in the Andes.
Not to Ireland.
And don't go to Ireland. I mean, go to Ireland because it's a beautiful place to visit. But go up to the high points of the Andes, and you'll find the origins of potatoes.
That was a lovely story from Shane Mitchell, who's a regular contributor. And she has a book coming out that's a sort of collection of these adventures and finding food in it and people who sort of preserve traditions in various places. So that worked out well because, potatoes are an interesting thing to know that they come in thousands of varieties and they some of them look like little weeds and some of them are beautiful purple and red.
Different colors, right?
Yeah, really, really incredible.
The red, she talked about the red potato, right. Something that I thought was particularly interesting was the article about Sean Sherman, about Native American foods. And it wasn't so much about what is the source of Native American cooking. It was about what one wouldn't use. Throwing out things that have infiltrated.
Right. Getting rid of sort of all the stuff that encroaches on how Native people actually ate. I mean, that was one where, that you're talking about the origins issue. We were sitting around and someone had heard about this food truck that was specializing in Native American food, and that sounded interesting. And then we did a little more research, and there's a really interesting chef who goes by the moniker the Sioux Chef.
Sioux tribe.
Yeah, not necessarily. Right. And then it gets into a really interesting topic about identity, about how we all define ourselves by the culture of what we eat and where that begins and ends and how you deal with authenticity. So and we all realized that we hadn't, we hadn't read a story recently about Native American cuisine. And here we are, talking about getting on planes. I've flown to a lot of faraway places to do stories. And I've, if you stop me on the street and ask me what did the native people of the country I live in eat, I really wouldn't have a very good answer.
Yeah. Well, as he mentioned, you throw out the sugar and no eggs and chickens because they weren't around until, the settlers came and brought things with them.
And any one of these stories, I mean, you could do a book, you could do a series of issues, potatoes, following it from Peru and how it ends up being, a key ingredient in Ireland would be fascinating.
Just listen to one of my shows. We did that one.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
The history of the potato and its travels.
Well, I always, sort of old movies when they would show the dotted line on a map of a plane, sort of going from continent to continent. And I wanted some of the stories in this issue to feel that way, that you're following the humble potato cod as it makes its way from this little archipelago in Norway to Venice, where it's still eaten every day.
Yeah. And I think those little dotted lines with planes are very helpful to people. I mean, they really, it gives them a whole perspective of our, our food world.
Yeah. It's a way of telling stories. So you can you can talk about who grew or procured a particular ingredient, or put together a dish. But I think when you pull the camera back a little bit and talk more broadly about, how foods, make it from one culture to another, or how tomatoes or potatoes make it to the New World and become what we think of as Irish or Italian food, is fascinating.
Yeah. Now, this origins issue, I will tell our listeners, covers periods from 4000 BC, we're talking there about wine, yeah, of course, right, all the way up to the 1860s, and that would be bunny chow.
Yeah.
Bunny chow being one of that odd dish that a lot of people don't know about, a South African dish, but very interesting fact that a lot of people, you know, it's talking about cultural appropriation,
yeah,
and I guess discrimination because of what foods you eat.
Right.
Bunny chow was one.
Yeah, this was a food that was came out of a dark period in the history of South Africa, and people found a way to, you know, turn a problem into, you know, a creative solution. And one of the things that's left over is this interesting dish, which is messy and sloppy and gloppy and really good, and a bunch of stuff shoved in a loaf of bread, essentially.
Well, and you can actually take it and eat on the run.
Yeah. It's like the walking tacos, or it's like a state fair food, but it happens to come from Durban, South Africa.
Right, and it's in curry, which, of course, the Indian culture was, you know, prevalent in English.
Yeah.
English were really the ones who dragged curry around the world.
But, yeah. That's a story that you're mentioning. It's about the Indian diaspora population in Durban. I guess Durban, if I'm remembering correctly, is the biggest Indian city outside of India.
That's saying something.
Yeah. But it's developed the food because of apartheid, because of distance, and because I think of just the normal, you know, wear and tear of how people end up kind of appropriating their own food or just going their own way with food. They ended up with an Indian cuisine that's very different from, you know, real, quote unquote, real Indian food, but it's its own thing. It's its own, you know, authentic thing in that it grew up there and it's what they like to eat.
Yeah, well, I just got back from Berlin and I was eating currywurst. Okay,
yeah, I think that's no trace of curry.
I don't think that's a whole show.
You should do a whole show, and we should do a whole issue about that kind of thing, because it's currywurst is so bland and weird and delicious.
I kept trying. What is this, ketchup sauce?
Right.
What
yeah.
is this?
And as you're eating, you're thinking, "This. Why did I come and have this?" And then a week later, when you're back in the States, you'll have a craving for it.
It's one of those. Yeah, I mean, it's like getting a hot dog from the guy in the cart and slathering it with, you know, mustard or ketchup. I like mustard and ketchup. I know I'm an oddity, but
we've got some hot dog origins stories coming soon.
Oh, good.
Teaser,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, great.
Have me back on to talk about hot dogs.
There's more I want to talk to you about this issue and future issues with Savour when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
And this one is called Carried Away by the Hollows. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
This a nightmare dream soaking gasoline. Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Adam Sachs, the editor-in-chief of Savour Magazine, and their new issue, which is on the newsstands right now. Well, right now, I say right now, it is here as we're recording this. It is September 13th. It'll be streaming on the 15th. If you listen in December, you'll just have to get a subscription and go online.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because these magazines, you know, I used to get really upset. I used to rip things out of you. I didn't like to rip pages out. I like to keep the magazines intact, so
yeah,
I would put stickies in all my magazines
everywhere.
Yeah, but then now I don't worry if the magazine gets thrown out by accident or intentionally, because the online presence is so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, it's you got things. Except there's something about the glossies that not all the pictures, not all the content is exactly the same.
Or even if it's there, you experience it differently. You interact with it differently.
Yeah.
There's something, I mean, I think if you like magazines or you work in magazines, you like that tactile quality. And I think everyone, most people these days, use both. They're not just a web reader or a print reader. If I make a recipe out of the magazine, I probably go on my phone because I'm in the supermarket
right,
looking for
exactly.
I'm at the market. But if I want to sit, comfortably and dig into a story, I like having the physical print object in my hands.
Hey, and you don't know if you're going to get internet access when
That's
you're
right.
traveling, so. I'll take a picture of the recipe and then go to the store.
Yes, I do that a lot.
The new technology. What did we do before that?
Yeah. Had to write it ourselves in longhand.
Well, in this issue, you really do, as I say, you do capture people's attention because the cover of the magazine looks like the usual covers of the magazines, a beautiful dish. This one happens to be a chicken or baked roasted chicken in a cream sauce with mushrooms. Mm, it looks wonderful.
Pretty tasty, I have to
say. Yeah, and that's the biggest print, pan roasted chicken. But right under the title, if anyone's looking, it says where wine was born, how soy sauce conquered the world, who invented the Reuben, and other mysterious tales. I would take that even if there weren't a picture. Well, obviously I would, but...
Yeah, the people in our circulation department would probably disagree or have my head if I just did an all-text cover.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I wanted, you want to get people in the supermarket as they're walking by and maybe they just want a recipe. But then for your loyal readers, you want to let them know that, hey, this is a special issue and we're doing something, not out of character, but we're going deep about these collections of sort of...
just a little, certainly not out of character, because as I said, that's something about Sevier, always told a story. I mean, if it's about an Italian pie, then
right.
you see a family
yeah.
enjoying the pie and making the pie, peeling the fruit. You always really did go to get more of source material. And I like that. This, of course, is answering a lot of questions that have been, in the back of people's minds and wondering about those things. Where did it come from? It seems like you can't... I love listening in on other people's conversations as I'm walking down the street. And it gets kind of boring because I would say 90% of the time they're talking about food.
Yeah.
Good. Are we food? Yes.
Are we at peak food nerdiness? I don't know.
I don't know either. And why suddenly is this happening? And there have been... food magazines and glossies for a long time.
Yeah.
And,
You think about social media, one example. I mean, everyone has the capacity or the technology now to share every little bit of your life. What are you really going to share? Are you really reading that many interesting books? You can't take a snapshot of your thoughts. You're probably treading the same routine, the same route to work and back every day. But food is something that we all eat, and it lends itself to being, I think, fetishized and focused on with our little phones.
Yes,
so
right.
it makes sense that that's the thing that you're gonna show off. It's obviously can be absurd. And on the other hand, I certainly check Instagram all the time and get turned on and excited by someone who's traveling somewhere I'd like to be eating, a dish I'd be curious about.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It does seem like we're more food obsessed people than we were, certainly when I got into the business.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of pictures, how many times have you been at a restaurant and seen somebody slap someone's hand who's about to eat and say, no, I've got to take a picture first.
I love the stories about people who sit near the natural light, even if it's not the table they want to be in, so that they can have the best Instagrammable light. And I'm sympathetic to it. I just can't quite bring myself to do that.
But the photographs are important. In fact, that is one thing I think that Sevier was maybe a first at and still does a good job. And because how people don't read anymore. They don't read more than a paragraph
or
two.
Reading's hard.
It takes time. But Sevier does a wonderful job giving pictorial essays. They really are beautiful pictures that tell a story.
I think especially in the early days of the magazine, it was before, it was such an important thing that you got this thing in your physical mailbox and they had sent someone to eat in Sicily and they had documented it with these beautiful photos and you saw inside people's kitchens and you saw dishes that, you could really see why you'd want to be curious about that dish and make it. And there wasn't a lot of competition for that at the time. And they really, in those, you know, first decade or so, really sort of patented a certain sort of approach to food photography that became kind of dominant. And you know, and now it's sort of how do you stand out in a world where everyone is snapping pictures of their food every day?
Well, it's obviously a very expensive magazine to produce. Am I allowed to ask what's the average cost of producing each issue?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It is expensive.
That's
I mean,
the other side of the fence. Yeah.
No, unfortunately, I have to know these things more than I did when I was a writer. But yeah, it's expensive. But you try to find, you know, you find ways to keep your costs down, and we try to shoot food, you know, on location when we can, and in real places that they were not trying to recreate it in the studio back in New York. But yeah, it's expensive.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I mean, that's the value of this tactile print thing and getting to sort of flip through the pages and spend a little time with it. It should have some production value. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to look at sort of a printout of your friend's Instagram.
Yeah. And holding it in your hands, as you say, it's, how much time can you spend in front of that computer screen? It's so nice to be able to flip pages back and forth. And for me, magazines and I often say it's no one living in my apartment, just magazines and books. But in research books particularly, you really cannot do online easily because you need to put your finger in one spot and then go to the next page and look up that index and look at
Or just flip around. I remember whenever I do that, I think back to being a kid in school and sort of picking up, you know, one volume of Encyclopedia Britannica or something. You're going to find things you didn't know. I mean, the internet is amazing for searching things. If I want to make, you know, a chicken dish or a whatever it is, I can find it instantaneously, but I can't sort of just meander. And I think magazines are great for meandering. I invariably read, I'll read, you know, a sentence in the middle of a story, get into it, read a few more, and then go back to the beginning and read it. And you would never do that online, really.
Yeah. Well, do you think this food obsession that and it's not just Americans, but having just come back from Europe and Scandinavia, I mean, they're crazy, obsessed as well. So we see the food, we've seen the photographs, and we've done that enough now. So do you think people are hungrier now for, well, you got to hope so because you wrote the magazine, hungrier for deeper stories, for finding the source, for knowing a little bit more about where our food comes from?
I think they want to know where our food comes from in different ways. They want to know actually, you know, who grew it and what's in it. And is it good for me? And does it have an interesting story? And then I think they want to know broader context. They want to, if you travel to eat, there's only so much eating you can do during the few days you're traveling generally. And then, but you can bring back, you know, you can then make a dish and tell your friends a story about it or bring back a souvenir. And it has, it's more valuable than just a thing because it's imbued with this memory. And I think with food, I think there is a real desire to sort of know a little bit more, to connect it. I think if you look at the success of a show like Chef's Table on Netflix, we've had food porn TV for a long time, but I think what that does is it gets inside the mind of these, just not to steal a title from another show, but it gets inside the mind of these chefs and tells a little story about their life and how they got there. And the food is, you know, shot beautifully and it's, the production values are high that I think it just brings in even a new audience who maybe didn't know, you know, don't follow the 50 best list.
Yeah.
And don't.
David Gelbis is an artist.
Yeah. He's a lovely guy. Actually saw him today. He's super smart about how they do it. You know, it's a formula and it works. You know, it makes you want to watch, you know, another one, even if you've been to the restaurant or, you know, the chef or, you know, or you feel like maybe you're slightly tired of talking about food because you work in food media and people are talking to you about it all day. There's something about watching those shows that is just very engaging.
Yeah, it is. And I think somebody did a survey and found, by and large, people who watch all the food shows do not cook.
Right.
They're eating
Chinese takeout
right,
on the couch.
Why not?
Yeah.
But food is, as you say, we all have to eat. We all eat it. So we might as well indulge ourselves in.
And it's the only
world.
You know, it's the only, you know, I think it can be very boring to talk about sort of food as art, but there is, it's the only thing that people do in a creative sense that you also, you know, put into your body. It's very intimate. It's very important.
Sensual.
You know, it's like, it affects how you feel. And if you're eating food that's, you know, made well or has a great story, then it makes you feel good about stuff. It just adds to the experience, I think. Yeah. It's not just, you know, nutrients going in and energy.
It touches a lot of senses.
Yeah.
Think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And things we'd like to know, you know, we like to know about history and culture and who makes this stuff. So, yeah, I think there are always more ways to tell stories about food.
Okay, another spoiler alert. There are so many good stories in this magazine. We're not going to give it all away because we want you to go to the newsstand to buy it.
We're not going to read the whole... Yeah, please buy it. Yeah.
But we
buy
have
a couple of copies. You might lose one, or you might want to lend it to a friend.
And, you know, if you're afraid you're going to miss the next one, just you get a subscription.
Yeah,
you know.
You have... Yeah, put one in your...
Okay, enough proselytizing. Here we go. But we do have to give a few teases,
yeah,
all right?
Geez.
And that is, how did Nachos get its name?
I love this story, yeah. And I'm going to forget the details, but...
I do, too. But, I can turn to the page.
It was a guy, Nacho, Ignacio.
Ignacio,
and
right.
some, I think some army wives came into his club. It was somewhere where there was an American army base. And they wanted food and drink, and he was out of food. So he just threw together this, you know, sort of improvised plate of stuff and called it, his nickname was Nacho, so he called it, you know, Nachos Especial or something. And and this improvised plate of stuff became this iconic thing that you eat while you're watching, you know, football games or I don't know. I love that it was just a, you know, kind of more or less an accidental food.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I was reading a lot of the articles with a little bit of a skeptical eye, knowing a lot of the folklore that surrounds the history of food and, you know, the history of the fork and the history of potatoes and you know, different stories about
the
wine
Reuben
origins and, you know, things like that. I mean, there are still arguments happening in the food world over, you know, Caesar salads and things like that.
Oh,
But even so, even those folkloric tales or myths are fun to know about.
Yeah.
They're fun to read.
They're versions of the history. The right.
And then you go into just, you know, the straight on, you know, historical background of things, which I think is great. So, is this something we're going to see annually now with Savour Magazine? Or,
well, if each and every one of your listeners goes out and buys 5 to 10 copies. No, if it, you know,
if it does well. Right,
I think it's... I think it's something, it's certainly a rich enough and sort of broad enough topic that we could do, you know, these twice a year. I don't know if we'll end up calling it the same thing, because then it might feel like, oh, I've seen that before. Mm. But I like this idea. I think we all on staff and the writers who were pulled into it, to the project, got excited about it. Because it's like we were saying, it's not a huge departure from what we do, but it's framing the story around these investigations and you know, there was a lot of sort of finding out digging up interesting facts and then sharing them all around the office. And,
so you listen to my show, you can hear all the great facts, but you don't get to see all the beautiful pictures.
Right.
And this magazine gives you pictures and travel pictures and food pictures. And yeah, well, one day we'll get all that. But I love the medium of radio, too, just because it lets people form pictures in their mind.
That's right.
While they're looking at Savour.
Yeah, exactly.
While they're looking at the magazine. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining me today. And yes, indeed, I encourage my listeners to go and look this up, because people who listen to my show love the origins of food anyway.
Yeah,
that's a given. Give it to your friend who doesn't listen to the show, and then they'll be Savour subscribers and subscribers to A Taste of the Past, so
fantastic.
Heritage Radio Network. And thank you for joining me. Thanks for doing such a great job with the magazine. I love it.
Thanks so much.
And thank you out there for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.